As we look at this first half of Daniel being kind of historical and some of the historical things that happened during primarily the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, but we'll find also a bit next week starting in with the very end of the Babylonian Empire, we see the nature of Daniel evolving and his interaction with the courts there in Babylon. And, of course, in the first chapter, we have him coming in as a young man and the trials they had of getting trained and, you know, basically going through, you know, Babylon University to become good Babylonians, and then their extra training and the sciences and things of their time. Chapter 2, we're introduced to the threat of him almost dying when Nebuchadnezzar has this dream that he can't understand. And I hope you understand that as we look at Daniel and these things, we're going to get another dream tonight, that this confluence of Nebuchadnezzar having dreams and Daniel being there is, of course, no accident. God has put Nebuchadnezzar in place for a specific task, and now Daniel and the people are there to protect them. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in one sense, is the protector of the remnant of the Jewish nation. And Daniel is put in a position where he can have influence over the court and over the things that happen during their 70-year period there. So he has the dream, and Daniel interprets it, and there's the great statue, and we talked about that. And then, of course, the next week is Nebuchadnezzar. I hope you're getting a little bit of picture of him, too, because now he goes, you know, that was a really neat dream of this big statue. Let's build a big statue, you know. So he builds a big statue and puts it out on the plain so that everybody can see it and kind of elevate himself is what he's really doing. I have no doubt that this statue was a statue of supposedly Nebuchadnezzar, you know, out there. That's what those guys did during those days, was, you know, touted all of their great things. And he, of course, had been pretty much conquering the world at that point in time. So once again, we see in the opening chapter here of chapter 4, an interesting statement being made by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's this part is told kind of from Nebuchadnezzar's standpoint. Although, you know, we're writing here in Daniel, and Daniel's going to report it. It comes out and it says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth, may your peace abound. It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Now, if we just look at that statement, that has all the hallmarks of being something that was engraved on a plaque somewhere. And probably Daniel simply is transcribing here, you know, some statement that Nebuchadnezzar had made, and it's kind of shocking when you first look at it. Here's a man who came from idolatry, effectively, and he's now here acknowledging the Most High God. Now, does that necessarily imply that he has given up all of his other belief in idols or other gods? No, it does not. And that part is, you know, something when you look at it, it's a strong statement. It's clearly an acknowledgement of something momentous in his life, but it falls short of being a declaration of there are no other gods. And did you notice two things about it when he's introduced there? How does he feel about himself when he starts out with that introductory clause? What's he king of? All the people, all the nations, all the languages. Okay, no ego problem here at all, right? Okay, that this guy is known as I'm the king, I am the king. But then he goes on and acknowledges Jehovah God. So now we have to find out why he would make this statement. So the explanation follows. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house, flourishing in my palace. And I saw a dream, and it made me fearful. And these fantasies as I lay on my bed and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dreams. Then the magicians and the conjurers and the Chaldeans and the diviners came in, and I related the dream to them, but they could not make its interpretation known to me. But finally, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and I related the dream to him. Now, if we stop there for a second, you see what I mean about him not being necessarily a monotheist at this point. You catch that? So, he's telling the story of how this came about, and he says, I had a dream. Now, why would a dream bother him? I mean, it's going to be kind of a funky dream when you look at it, and of course it's got some disturbing parts. But why would the king not just go, I'm the king, don't worry about this, it's just a dream? Okay, it says right there that whatever this dream was, it made him afraid. Now, guy with an ego like Nebuchadnezzar, in a position of Nebuchadnezzar, is he used to being afraid? No. And so he wants to fix this. He wants to fix it. So he calls in the same troop of guys that he called in the second chapter, right? Now, there's probably some years in between here. We don't know how many. It doesn't give us a time reference here. There's been some time frame in between. And he calls them all in. Now, Daniel is well known by this point because he's going to get called in later. And it opens the question of why wasn't Daniel called in first or with the other group? And I think there you see, again, providence. For whatever reason, he's kind of hung back to the side until all these others have been proven to be inadequate. They're not going to be able to help. What's the difference here in this dream and the one in chapter 2, though, in the way the king's handling it? Yeah, in chapter 2, remember, he wouldn't tell them the dream. They had to tell him the dream. Okay? So now he's told he's going to tell them the dream, but they're still not going to be able to do anything with it. And at least to his satisfaction. They may have made something up, who knows, but clearly he's not satisfied. He's worried about it still, and so he calls in Daniel. Benjamin and I were discussing at lunch. Did you notice how the friends of Daniel keep being called by their Babylonian names? And Daniel is just called Daniel, except where he's addressed by Nebuchadnezzar or one of the other Babylonians, and then they use his other name. And he's like, I wonder why that is. And so he wrote the book. You know, so he gets the option of putting his own name in there. But he gets called in later, and he's going to hear the dream. And again, this is him coming in a condition where he's clearly going to have influence, but he has to be careful. Think about his position as he's going in front of Nebuchadnezzar. You remember what Nebuchadnezzar said about the last group of guys that came in and said, if you can't interpret the dream, what was he going to do? You got to love it, right? Tear them limb from limb, impale them on posts, you know, turn their houses into rubbish heaps. This is not a guy who threatened lightly. You know, if he said off with their head, what happened? Off with their head, right? So that's where Daniel is standing. And he says in verse 8 there, but finally Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And I related the dream to him, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, since I know that a spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery baffles you, tell me the visions of my dream which I have seen, along with its interpretation. Now these were the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. And the tree grew large and became strong, and its height reached to the sky, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its foliage was beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. And the beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches, and all living creatures fed themselves from it. I was looking in the visions in my mind, and as I lay on my bed, and behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven. And he shouted out and spoke as follows, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its foliage and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches. Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field. And let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let 7 periods of time pass over him. This sentence is by decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows it on whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. So there's the dream. You got the first part, which is a description of the tree. And as I was reading it again last night, looking at it, I don't know why, but it popped in my head. You know, what was that Avatar movie or whatever? You know, had the giant tree in it. They probably got it out of here. So, you know, giant tree, it's big, it's pretty, it's beautiful, it shelters everything. And notice, you know, the description, all the animals are underneath it, they're great, it's food. You know, it's idyllic, right? Cool, big giant tree. Now what happens to it? Cut down. But who declares that it should be cut down? Who comes down and makes the announcement? Interesting there. Yeah. Depending on your translation, it may say just Holy One. It may say Angelic Watcher. There's different ways that's translated. It's another one of those. Maybe we'll do a lesson on these one of these days. We don't know a lot about the angels, but what we find out about them is kind of interesting in the roles that they play in various places. This is obviously a spokesperson for God, right? Delivering a message. He recognizes in the dream that this is a heavenly being, someone of authority that supersedes those on the earth. Does that make sense? So that's what he's witnessing, is someone that in his dream even, he understands has more authority than he does. And the tree gets cut down. Now why in the world would you cut down a perfectly good tree? Why would you cut down a perfectly good tree? Yeah. Might not be a perfectly good tree, right? There's obviously something wrong with this tree. And so it's going to get cut down. But not completely destroyed. Notice how it says, leave the stump. Leave the roots. You're going to put an iron band around it. Why do you do that? Well, it just kind of keeps the trunk from splitting or whatever. Preserves part of it. The intent there is that under the right conditions, something of that tree might grow back. Probably would never attain the stature that it had before, but it gives that option. Which is interesting because this whole image of trees and growing and representing things is used a lot in the Old Testament, isn't it? You know, you see, you know, even in the Psalms, what's the second Psalm? As a tree planted by the waters, you know. That's how Christians are supposed to be, or people of God, you know, at that time. You see images of the branch being used in Isaiah, where it's talking about the branch of the tribe of Judah coming forth. And we know being Christ eventually coming forward. And you've heard me talk before about, you know, that living force that simply wouldn't be denied. Was going to grow up into that branch. I mean, the life force was so strong in it. But here, this one, it's not talking about necessarily that one. It's talking about this tree that only survives because the angelic watcher says, we'll give it a chance and we'll see what happens. So, there's the dream. Now, Daniel, having heard it, it doesn't say that he has to think a whole lot about it. Last time, he kind of went away and came back with interpretation. Right.
The angels right there are, you know, immediately say, okay, cut down the tree, but then let his mind, let him be changed from a human. So it's already taking that out of the anthropomorphic stage and directly into the human.
Yeah. Did you notice that transition there? Benjamin was bringing up that transition that says, talking about the tree, and then it says, and let him, and his mind. So it's clearly talking about someone. You know, that transition is clear in the dream. You know, it makes me wonder when you see something like this. You're gonna, it's almost pretty obvious, isn't it? What's going on here? I mean, this is one of those dreams that you're going, why did he need a bunch of magicians to tell him what this dream was about? That's a good question. Why did he call in all these people to tell him what this dream was about? Oh yeah, I think there's some of that. We'll see that with Daniel coming up, right? You think the king kind of had it maybe figured out a little bit? It's quite possible, but, you know, do you think this is a dream and an interpretation he wants? No. So he's going to call in all these other people to kind of see if the message isn't quite what he thinks it might be, you know? He's going to call this in, and I want this dream interpreted. Now, here's Daniel standing in front of a guy who had previously threatened to kill everybody. has just told him this dream, and Daniel, by God, has given the answer to it, and it's not a good answer. He's got a couple of choices. Telling the truth or procrastinate. And he's standing there, and obviously he understands it right away, because it says, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him. And the king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. And Belteshazzar replied, my lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. So, you think Daniel understands the potential consequences of telling him the truth here? Yeah, and they might be bad, just depending on how he takes it. So he's perplexed. He's got to figure out a good way to sort of introduce this. You notice how he did it? I really love that. It's a really good way of saying, this is bad news, but I really wish it didn't apply to you. What is he doing in a statement like that? Okay, he is showing respect for Nebuchadnezzar. He is showing Nebuchadnezzar that he really is on his side and that he's got an unpleasant job to do here. And he says, but here's the interpretation. The tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, whose height reached to the sky and was visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful and its fruit abundant, and which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt and in whose branches the birds of the sky lodged, it is you, O king. For you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. So he's acknowledging the reality of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And in fact, if you look at history, Nebuchadnezzar did put together a formidable army. He went out and just routed the Assyrians, took over all of their territory, consolidated that part of the kingdom, and then expanded beyond that, took territory that the Assyrians were never able to hold. And he did it in a way that was really almost, well, it was the best golden age for a long time in terms of large empires until basically the Persians came along. And things were actually fairly prosperous under Nebuchadnezzar. He kind of epitomized the benevolent dictator kind of person. His idea was, we want all of these nations to be solid. We want them to be prosperous. His philosophy was actually pretty good, right? If they're prosperous and they're doing well, then they're less likely to rebel and they'll pay more taxes. And so he had money coming in. He was wealthy. He had built Babylon as a city. It was amazing when you look at the ruins of it. Walls that were high, it straddled a river that went right through the middle of it. And the Ishtar Gate, if you go look that up and look at the pictures that are in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, they kind of hold that one back and reconstructed it in there. It's huge, and it's got all these beautifully glazed blue tiles, and it would have been right on a procession way where anybody marching into the city would have immediately been impressed with all that they'd put together. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the wonders of the world, had been built at Nebuchadnezzar's direction. So he had everything. And he was pretty benevolent. What was the problem? Yeah. He had a little bit of arrogance, ego, pride. He had done all of these things. We'll see that in a second. He had done all these things. The dream, as you listen to that angelic watcher, what does he say is the real root of Nebuchadnezzar's success? Look at verse 17. Who's really the ruler? The Most High. The Most High. So there we have the conflict between Nebuchadnezzar and what God had set up for Nebuchadnezzar. And so Daniel opens up with this, I wish it were plain to your adversaries. The tree which you saw is you. And he gives him that first part. And then in verse 23 he says, in that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it and the new grass of the field, Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts of the field until seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And that in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is the heaven that rules. Therefore, King, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. What's Daniel's advice? Straighten up. Repent. Be a little bit more open to your people. Take care of them a little better, because God has entrusted this to you. Nebuchadnezzar had a trust from God. Whether he knew it was from the Most High God at that time or not, he had been given that trust. And as the king, it was his responsibility. And he wasn't holding it up the way he needed to. Now, there's a couple of interesting things there. It says that he is going to be basically driven out of his mind. Okay, what do you get out of that description? What's going to happen to him? Yeah, it's going to go kind of crazy, and he's going to be pretty much like an animal. The description that it gives there is of some form of insanity, you know, that he's going to lose his mind. How long is it going to be gone? Yeah. It says seven periods of time. We have to understand that in Daniel, like in a lot of the apocalyptic books and the books of visions, the numbers sometime are symbolic of what's going on. And seven is a complete number. It's a perfect number. We'll be talking more about numbers a little bit later in the book. And, of course, when we start in Revelation next quarter, we'll have to talk a lot about numbers. But seven was a perfect number. It basically is God's number. It just means that it takes the time that it takes. And then there's a little word there called until. So how long is it going to take? It's going to take until what? Until he figures it out, right? Whatever time span that was. You know, days, weeks, months, we don't know. Now, I've had a lot of people that talk about this book, and you look and you go, okay, is there anything in history that pinpoints this, that says, you know, that Nebuchadnezzar, basically went crazy and then came back and got his kingdom? Because you see, he comes back later, and we're going to find out he gets his kingdom back. That's not normal, folks. Usually the king goes crazy. What happens? Yeah, eldest son or somebody else takes charge, out with the king. But in this case, somehow it's all held together for whatever this period of time was. But let me remind you of the way the records were written back then. Okay? Who wrote the records of all of these events? The king's historian. Who had to approve all of the records that were written? The king, right? Why else, when Sennacherib had most of his army totally destroyed when surrounding Jerusalem, and he gets back to report on it, and we have his report in a cylinder that says, I caged up Hezekiah like a bird inside of Jerusalem, and then we went home. He's certainly not going to admit that he lost the bulk of his army there, right? I mean, that doesn't look good in history. And since I'm writing history, will make me look good. So it's not likely that we'll ever find anything about this written in those records. But we do have a lot of records from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. It's really interesting. We doubt that there's a lot of historical stuff from that time period. And so we know a lot about the kingdom and his administration and the wars that he fought and those kinds of things. And a lot of the times and events and things line up with stuff that shows that this what Daniel has written is certainly in harmony and in sync with that time period. But you don't find a lot in this particular case of a historical record that happens to match up exactly with the Daniel record. There are a few. We'll get that in the next chapter. Okay? The very end of the empire is a classic case of what is written there in Daniel and what's predicted is exactly what happens. So with that being said, we look at this tree, this dream. He's been told now that he's the tree. There's a problem. The tree can get cut down. Daniel gives him advice and says, maybe if you repent, turn away from this, then your reign will be prolonged. Your prosperity will be prolonged. Well, apparently it changed his mind a little bit. But you know, when nothing happens, when a dire warning is given, over time, what happens? You kind of go back to the way things were, right? And it hasn't happened today, didn't happen yesterday, and pretty soon it becomes a distant memory. And the day-to-day cares of running a kingdom that size pretty much overshadow what might have happened a year ago. Because in verse 28, it says, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king, and 12 months later, a year, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? And while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. And you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field, and you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is the ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. Now, that last there, do you recognize that as part of the same wording that came in the very first, the plaque? So there's the story of how this came to be. Driven away from mankind. We do not know how he lived, how they preserved the kingdom, what happened there. Those are all good questions. I have no answers other than history says that Nebuchadnezzar finished out his reign until he died. And apparently came back. But we also know that towards the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, things were not as smooth as they had been during the early part of his reign. And so if you look at the records, things began to kind of unravel a little bit. There were some problems. And especially when you started looking at succession, it turns out that if you look at the Babylonian kings, there was, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was great and he ruled a good long time. After that, it was kind of haphazard for a while for the next 2 or 3 or 4 kings. Babylon didn't last all that long. And if you look at the history there, you kind of have to wonder if maybe this wasn't a turning point that started the downward fall of what Babylon was going to be. He recognized this. He came out with that strong statement. And then in verse 35, it says, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? At that time, my reason returned to me, and my majesty and my splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. And my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Sure.
I must have read this, I don't know how many times, but I just noticed something that the in verse 34 to 37 uses the first person pronoun. Prior to that, in verse 33, the second person pronoun is used. And I just want to see if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. What you're looking at here is a piece that Daniel has put together from both his perspective of what was going on, where he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar, and from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective about what happened to him. Yes, yes. Something that he either proclaimed or wrote down or whatever. So if you look at the very beginning of the chapter, same thing there, where it says, Nebuchadnezzar the king to all the people. That is Nebuchadnezzar speaking. And it's probably, that's first person there. And it was probably, we don't know for sure. We haven't found the plaque, but it would be just like something that they would put on an inscription someplace, so that all the people could see it. And I think that's the same kind of sense you get towards the bottom. And so that's what I think links the beginning in first person, the end in first person, and then we get kind of Daniel's rendition in between of what happened there. It's an interesting story, and I think there's a lot of points that we look at here. Clearly, none of us are Nebuchadnezzar, right? We don't have to worry about being king of the world and having all of these great things in front of us. However, that sin that Nebuchadnezzar was really having a problem with there, pride. I mean, that's really kind of a common human thing, isn't it? Isn't pride really something that everybody has to watch out for? It's really easy to have the same thing happen that got Nebuchadnezzar 12 months later. What did he say? He's just walking on the roof and he's kind of looking over his town, you know? And he's looking out there and what's his thoughts? Start turning. Yeah, look at what I've done. This is actually pretty cool, folks. I did all this. It took me a while. It was a lot of hard work, but I got it done. We could say that about a lot of things, couldn't we? Careers, jobs, things that people accomplish. There are lots of things we could look at and go, yeah, I did it. And we lose sight of the fact that everything we've got, everything that we do, the talents that we have that we can bring to bear to accomplish things, are all gifts. You know, they're gifts from God. Now, we are expected to use those gifts. It's not that we are to sit, you know, humbly in a pile somewhere and not do anything because we don't want to get, you know, be proud. That's not the point. The point is to recognize who is the ruler, who is responsible, and that's what Nebuchadnezzar was having problems with. Ken. You know, history doesn't show any big change there. If you look at even subsequent to him, the temples of the idols are still there. There's no indication that he necessarily tried to, like, break down idolatry or anything like that. There's a big open question there. And that's why I say, you know, when we get to heaven and we can get some questions answered that we still have, it wouldn't surprise me one way or the other. You know, Nebuchadnezzar may have himself figured it out and realized that the other gods were nothing. And turn to God. That's possible. But he also may, you know, have never come to a complete realization of what was there. And it certainly didn't pass on. It wasn't something that he influenced the rest of the kingdom with. David. Oh, yes.
So a lot of historians prior to like 30 years, you know, prior to today, said God was in a way, you know, there was no such thing. But now they're going back, looking at the old Babylonian records and saying, yeah, there was co-regency.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we get that more in the next chapter. Eventually we'll cover that next week. But the last king that Daniel lists is Belshazzar. And the last one that's recorded in history is Nabonidus. And so for a long time, that was one of the places that they pointed to and said, can't be correct. But it turns out that Belshazzar was Nabonidus' son, and Nabonidus liked wandering a whole lot. And so he left the son in charge while he was out doing other things. Co-regent. He basically left him in charge as king while the dad went out and had fun. And it turns out that that was actually kind of a common practice back in those days. So during this time, we don't know exactly what the lineage was there for Nebuchadnezzar taking over. I don't know if you've got one or not, but in one of the books that I handed out, there's a list of the Babylonian kings, and Mine's in my briefcase. I'll get it later. And you'll see there that the next few kings, it changed lines a couple of times. And Belshazzar wound up being like the great-grandson or something like that. But in between, there was some general that took over for a while, and there were several revolts and, you know, those kind of things back and forth. Yeah. And you can't go there. You know, Daniel turns out to be really cool because it's historically accurate as you start pointing things out like that. Sorry. If you think of it again, just... So, you know, as we look at a case like this, and these are really good questions that you bring up, we do have a lot of things that we can't answer. You know, I can't show you some historical things there. But on the other hand, there's enough for us to be able to look at this and say, you know, I can understand this happening. And Daniel laying out precisely what went on, you know, in that time period with Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, and so we don't know which came first, because some of the Psalms were written earlier or later, but several of these verses that are a praise to God, you'll find them in the Psalms. Now, it could be that Daniel read them to Nebuchadnezzar, or it could be that they were recorded during that time period. It became part of the Psalms, you know, later on as they were assembled. The Psalms were assembled over a pretty extended period. But either way, this language certainly is biblical, solid, used in a number of different places, and this image is used in a number of different places as well.
There's no indication that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar came across the line, but he might refer to it as a God-fearer. It was unusual for any kingdom to recognize gods of the nations outside of their own, especially nations that they had conquered. So the general thought was, if I can take over your kingdom, my gods are stronger than your gods. And so even his admission that, first of all, Jehovah existed, and second of all, he was the Most High and had these other powers, was clearly an admission of understanding that there was something special going on here. We don't really get any indication of more than that, but at the very least, Nebuchadnezzar recognized there was a big difference between the God of these Jews and all of the other nations that he was allowed to conquer.
Definitely. You didn't hear, Benjamin, one of the points that, you know, we've talked about in the past was when these countries all went to war, one of them beat the other one, that basically meant my God was better than your God, you know. They all claimed God and country as their, you know, rallying points, so whoever won, obviously their God was stronger. And here we have a God of a defeated people being praised as the Most High God. So that was very unusual, very unusual. Anything else? All right. I am reluctant to go on because the next chapter is really kind of a whole deal and we're not going to get too far into it. But we wanted to give you a little bit of homework. You need to read through that before we get there because this is a really interesting one. And you'll find that several interesting things to look up. They wind up calling back vessels from the temple. Now, this is towards the end of the reign. So we're looking at not quite 70, but almost 70 years after the first spoils have been taken from Jerusalem by the time you get to the next chapter. And when you look at that, it is the next chapter, right? Isn't that Daniel 5? Was the Belshazzar at the end of the kingdom? I'm seeing that, and all of a sudden yes, the handwriting on the wall. You got to ask yourself how all that stuff survived. And again, looking at Providence, and then when they leave again from Persia, finding that all of those things were taken out. One of the things that we do know is that they built the equivalent museums. Now, they were attached typically to the temples of their gods and things like that. But all of those things that had been used in service to Jehovah God, Nebuchadnezzar collected, you know, and put them in the house of his God, and then wound up preserving them for the 70 years. Kind of interesting there that we got things preserved that they could take back with them. So there's a lot of neat points for next week, and we'll take a look at that one then. Anything else before we close for tonight? All right, thank you.